Hi, everybody. Good evening. My name is Franny, and I'm an alcoholic. And just because I'm so excited about it, I want to tell you, I think you do it the way we do it in California, in that you've got sort of a week to get your birthday cakes. So this is my birthday week. I'm 26 years old. And now that I'm 26 and 2 days, I can tell everyone that I'm well into my 27th year. Because I, seriously, I don't know how the rest of you act, but that's the way I'm hardwired. I would like to register a complaint. I just want you to know, I think there are entirely too many men on the committee. And the reason that is very apparent to me is because Bonnie and I got to talk tonight, and Carter and Lynn are the rebuttal speakers tomorrow. Neil. So I know that it's a conspiracy, and I would like that corrected immediately. Yeah. You know, it's a funny thing. You know, they tell us we should share in a general way, but it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now. And the thing I have noticed over time is that the longer a man is sober, the better his story gets. And the other thing that I've noticed is that in some cases, not in all cases, but actually in many cases, the longer a woman is sober, the worse her story gets. It gets real boring. She starts leaving things out because, after all, when you get sober and you clean up and you start looking like a lady and you start acting like a lady, then obviously ladies would not talk about those things we did that got us here. And I think what that does, okay, now you know where we're going, right? All right? And I think what that does is it puts us in the position occasionally of being there and being happy and serene in our sobriety and not providing any support whatsoever for that newcomer broad that's sitting over there in the corner looking for somebody to tell her what to do, you know? So I have promised that there's certain parts of my story, regardless of how many times I tell my story, I try to tell these absolutely the same way, and I'll tell you what they are. And the other thing is that I have actually had more growing experiences sober than I ever had when I was a drunk. But I managed to get enough in to get the newcomers identified, and then I always get sober in about the last 10 minutes of my pitch, you know, and I really try to work on that, so I would like to do that tonight, because the truth of the matter is the learning experiences happen after you quit drinking. You know, God's opportunities are provided to you before you quit drinking. But as far as any successful response to them, I was never able to do that until after I quit drinking. So I'm going to try to talk about that. You know, the first thing I want to say is I drank 4 times before I was 21. I know some people started drinking, they started sneaking whiskey into their milk bottles. I know that. But you know, that's not me, you know. What happened was the first time I was 6.5 years old, and my sister Ann and I were serving drinks at one of my father's parties because we were cute, and we drank everything on our trays. We were carrying this booze into the guests, and instead of making a right-hand turn into the living room, the two of us with trays full of drinks walked straight into the closet, and the two of us drank everything on the tray. Both trays. And I want you to know that the next morning, there we are, 6 sober, sorry, and 6.5 years old, okay? Bleeding from the eyeballs, full of remorse and wondering what happened, I guess. I don't remember. Now, what are you going to do? You got this midget. You're going to take her. You're going to put her little butt right up here on the podium. You're going to look right into her beady brown eyes, and you're going to say, Franny, you've got to cool it. You drink too much. And what are you going to do? You know, my family did the thing that Irish Catholic families in New York did at that time. They made a funny story out of it, and we went on. And we always used to dredge up all these funny stories whenever we had one of these family feasts, you know, Christmas, New Year's, Easter, baptisms, confirmations, Holy Communions, you know, whatever the festival was, even if it was just a meal, you know, first the booze came out, and then the stories happened. And I grew up in the family. We had an elephant in our living room that we never talked about. Nobody ever used the word alcoholic or sick in my family. I knew that my mother called AA on my father and tried to turn him in a couple times. And in a way, that's part of my story, because I remember, you know, some of those pictures that they show you, you know, with these guys standing there with these clean overcoats and these nice fedoras, and they're clean. These are the kind of men that used to come to the door when my mother reported my father, but Daddy always got away, so he never had the opportunity to get to AA. And I come from a determinedly alcoholic family. My father had cancer of the larynx when he died, so they were feeding him through a tube in the stomach, and my job was to buy the booze and then bring it to the hospital and put it in my mouth and mix it with my saliva and then put it straight into his stomach, along with whatever else he was getting, because that was the only way they could feed him. And we thought it was, my father's dying of cancer, and we thought it was a lark to take a flower in a vase, dump the water, fill it up with vodka, go in, and you know, of course, he thought it was a big joke, too. He said, you can bring me flowers every day, you know. Died drunk and laughing is the way he went. And I think that was what he wanted. I don't know, but that showed me how people die. That's what I grew up with. My father's my mother was an alcoholic, but nobody knew it. My father was the kind of man that would make anybody look sober if you put them next to him. So we didn't know my mother was an alcoholic until after Daddy died. The simple fact is you can't see the moon when the sun is out. And that's the way it is. I have two sisters. They're both alcoholics. The three of us are alcoholics. My grandparents are alcoholic. I have four kids. My daughter goes to ACA because she doesn't want to admit she's like me. And all three of my sons are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're all married. Well, and they're all married to these California blonde black belt Al-Anons. That's what they're married to. Correction. Two of those are also alcoholics. You know, so I'm wondering what kind of a legacy we're giving the grandkids. But I watch those kids at Christmas, and I know which ones are going to need to get here. I can see it. It's an amazing family disease. And the thing is that alcoholism absolutely shattered my family. I have living relatives. I have no idea where they are, including my two sisters. I have no idea. Alcoholism destroyed my family. And Alcoholics Anonymous was able to heal the members of my family out here, in California, that chose to get sober. So, you know, all I got to say is alcoholism kills and AA works. That's what I know. That's my truth. The second time I drank, I got drunk. I was 14 years old, and that's the first time I ever saw the Al-Anon face. You know that look they give you where you're supposed to know what to do? They don't say anything. They just look at you. You know who you are. I never had a clue. I never had a clue what the world wanted from me. But I did find out when I was 14 years old that I could outweigh anybody. I found out that I couldn't get hostile because otherwise I'd get a beating. And I couldn't get apologetic because otherwise I'd get put up against the wall and get 2.5 hours of everything I ever did wrong in my life. But I did know that if I wasn't hostile and if I wasn't apologetic, eventually you would run down, you would start either crying or screaming, but eventually you would go away and leave me alone so I could do what I wanted. That was my lesson at 14. At 17, I drank, and I got drunk, and I got pregnant. And at 18, I drank, and I got drunk, and I got married. So I should have known I had a problem with booze. But if you'd said anything to me about it at that time, I would have told you, hey, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly in the beginning. And I'm just learning how, so go away, get out of my face, and let me get to be an adult. Because in my world and in my mind, if you couldn't drink, you weren't an adult. Kids can't drink. Adults drink. That was very simple for me. So in order to be an adult without making any kind of effort, all I had to do was try to learn how to drink. And you know, that was my problem. I never could. I killed myself trying to prove that I could drink and not turn into the kind of an animal my father was. I spent most of my life trying to prove that I could drink successfully. That was my effort. I think at one time I had the perfect experience, and I spent the rest of my life trying to recreate it and never succeeded. You know, and nearly killed myself in the attempt. That guy that got me pregnant, we got married, we went to California, and he was Catholic too. So we had a kid, we had another kid, we bought a car, we had another kid. We bought a house, we had another kid. I don't know, by the time I was 24 years old, I had 4 kids, and I had a car and a mortgage. And see, this guy really, all he wanted to do was be a Los Angeles fireman, make the money that he needed to make to support his family, have a bunch of kids running around, a house with a white picket fence, a couple of dogs, a couple of cats, bring his paycheck home and give it to his wife, and she'd pay the bills. And see, that's where his program fell apart. That was not my intention. He wound up trying to control the money because what happened was the other women used to have coffee for the coffee clutches, and whenever I had the coffee clutch, I'd serve cream sherry. And after they left, I'd finish the cream sherry, and when he came home, I'm lying on the couch checking my eyelids for light leaks, you know, and telling him that I had a headache and I couldn't fix supper. And interestingly enough, you know, that's a very petty way, but that was the beginning. He would take the kids for hamburgers, and that was the beginning of my family's accommodating to my disease. I wasn't able to function as a wife or as a mother anytime I drank. That's all. So, you know, he thought I was cute drunk for a while, but it wasn't funny for very long. And I kept falling down on the job more and more, and he kept being able to come home to a clean house less and less. And the kids were starting to develop very definite patterns of independence simply because they didn't have a mother there to take care of them. I mean, I was there, but I wasn't present, you know. And we saved a little money, and we bought a house in Redondo Beach for income, and then we moved down there. And I was down on the beach one day, and I'm walking around, and I saw these people that were absolutely fascinating. The guys had these bell-bottomed hip huggers and with big wide belts, and they were barefooted, and they had vests with no shirts, and they had hair bands, and their hair was longer than some of the girls. And the girls all looked like Russian peasants, you know. They had these fluff blouses and these full skirts, and they're running around saying, "Peace, brother." And I don't know about you, but I'm always attracted by people who are smiling when nobody's looking, and these people were smiling when nobody was looking. But I didn't know that it wasn't serenity, it was marijuana. And I never cared for marijuana. I don't like anything that slows me down. And my idea was, if my ideal life would be to party until the day I died. And what I found out was, none of them had much money, but I had a little money. I was a housewife. And my husband came to me one time and he said, "Franny, I got to tell you," he said, "I can support the family, but I can't support the tribe. You know, there's something wrong here." Because what I had done was, I had hooked myself in with these guys. You know, and in about 4 weeks or so, I guess, what I did was I went home and I threw away my purses and I threw away my little hats with the little veils, you know, and I threw away my gloves and I threw away my stockings and I threw away my high-heeled shoes and I stopped shaving my legs and under my arms. And in no time, I'm down there hairy, happy, and hippie too, you know, with all my buddies. And he had no idea what was going on, but he knew that somehow or other, this was not in accord with his plan for the universe. I knew that much. And I was drinking every day, and I started... it wasn't really that I ever intended to be unfaithful to him, but, you know, I looked at him one day, and I realized he was so normal, he just wasn't much fun. I mean, he was responsible. He got up and went to work every day. And he wanted supper fixed when he came home. Blah, you know? I knew that once I was 21, I was going to drink successfully, and that's what I spent my life trying to do. And he came to me one time, and he said, "You know," he says, "you turned into a slob and a slut." He says, "I'm tired of your act." He says, "I never see you when you're sober anymore." He says, "I don't know what's going on." He says, you're not cute. He says, you know, I don't know who you are. I want you to get out of my life and send back my wife. Because as far as I can see, you're some kind of devil that has replaced her. You are not the girl that I married. You're not the woman that had my children. And you're not the lady that I want to go into my old age with. So why don't you just disappear and send my wife back? And this man, like I say, the Los Angeles Fire Department doesn't raise any wimps. This man stood there with these big tears rolling down his face, folding and unfolding a kitchen towel while he's telling me, please, who are you and where's my wife? And you know, the best that I could give that situation was what I had learned to do when I was 14 years old. I stood there and waited for him to run down. Because people used to say to me, what's wrong with you? Don't you love us? Why do you do these things? And you know, I never had an answer. I would come rolling in at 4 o'clock in the morning still drunk with very little idea of where I had been or what I had done or who I was with. And he would say to me, what am I doing wrong? Why do we have this? I couldn't answer him. The thing I couldn't do until after I got sober was talk about the pain of sobriety. You know, I know as an alcoholic, I cannot stand reality. That's why the program's not about quitting drinking. The program is about get the drinking out of the way so that you can start working the steps so you can live a successful life. See, the program's not about giving up booze. Get clear on that. Because if all we had to do was give up booze, any one of us could have done it a long time ago. But the thing is that it's not about that. Booze made it possible for me to stay alive. Booze made it possible for me to stay out of insane asylums. Booze made it possible for me to tolerate you because I couldn't stand you. I felt like I was such an alien. Everybody around me knew not only what to do, they know when to do it, and they were able to do it perfectly the first time. I was constantly tripping on my tail or tripping on my tongue or trying to figure out, what is going on here? Why am I so wrong again? I never had an answer. It was like I was always playing catch up with what everybody around me did naturally. And I'll tell you, when I put a couple of slugs of whatever it was, I was a general practitioner. I took everything. What I know is, when I changed myself, you improved. Now that's the magic of alcoholism. And do you know what that's on a level to? That's on the same level as drinking the turpentine and watching the table refinish itself. That's why they call it, you know, the magic elixir. It's the only thing in the world that I can treat me with to improve you. But that's what it did do. It made you okay. It made the lights a little brighter. It made the music a little better. It made the voices a little friendlier. You know, there was more of a sense of okay. And that's what I needed because, very honestly, I hated myself and I couldn't tolerate you, you know. And that doesn't leave you many to talk to. So this guy is wondering what's going on with his wife. And, you know, occasionally I wondered about too, but I'd have a couple of drinks and I'd forget about it. He came to me and he said, you know, we got some serious business to talk about, but in the meantime, Buddy's going to be 8 years old today, and I want him to have a decent birthday party. This is my oldest son. He said, so I'm going to work for half a day, and I'm coming home, and by the time I come home, I want the house clean and in order. I want a birthday cake. I want ice cream. I want the kids in the neighborhood about 3 o'clock. You know, let's just get some of his friends together, and let's give him a birthday party. So you know, that was all that man wanted to do. He wanted to give that kid a birthday party. So as soon as he went to work, I took the kids down to the beach because we only lived a few blocks from the beach. I took the kids down to the beach, and I let them play down on the beach while I went up to Tony's on the pier and talked about the birthday party with my good friend Kenny the bartender. I mean, I had to plan, and I couldn't even think unless I had a drink in my hand. So I was planning, and while Kenny and I were planning, I think we spent about 3 minutes on the birthday party, and then it got into the usual bar stuff, whatever that was. And but I'm sitting there, and I'm starting to feel a little better. And this idiot, this turkey, this nerd, this geek, comes walking in at the other end of the bar, and he sits down at the far end of the bar, and he buys me a drink. Well, you have to be polite. So I started drinking 151 Mai Tais, and every time he bought me a drink, he'd move closer one seat. Nothing new yet, right? So then, just as he got to the seat next to me, you know, he completely forgot his intentions on my body and went wandering out. And, you know, that's a drinking woman's dream. I had a guy walk up to me one time after my pitch, and he said, you know, I learned more about my wife in the last hour than I ever knew before. I said, why? He said, because I learned a lot about her by when she laughed when you were talking. Anyway, you know, the next thing that I know is that my husband is standing behind me, and he's got his hands on my neck, and he's dragging me off the bar stool. And have you ever seen a man that's so mad he's ready to kill? The cords on his neck stand out and his face turns bright red. Well, that's where this guy was at. And he dragged me off that bar stool and out of that bar and down the pier past all my fine friends that were out there fishing and spitting, you know, and right down to the end of the pier where the kids were waiting to see what Daddy and Mommy were going to do now. And I had a moment of clarity, I guess. I had lots of moments of clarity. I used to ignore them, but this one I paid a little attention to. And I pulled some money out of my pocket, and I handed it to my daughter, who was a year older than the birthday kid. And I said, look, you guys buy ice cream and walk home. By the time you get home, we'll have the party. I mean, what do you need to do? Buy a birthday cake. And everything will be fine. And he poured me into the car, and we went home. And this is one of those exact wording situations. I never want to change this because people need to hear this. The next thing I remember is the phone was ringing and I had it to my ear. And my daughter, who was 9, is saying, Mommy, please come down here quick. We don't know what happened. But he was sitting on the railing of the pier and I guess he finished his ice cream. And we don't know whether the boys were playing around or his hands were slippery. But he went over backwards on over the railing of the pier and he went into the water. And we can't find him. Now, I want to tell you something. I know for a fact that there are times when you can get shocked absolutely into cold operational sobriety. I have no idea how long you can maintain it because you still have the booze in your body. Well, what happened to me was all of a sudden I was totally present. I put my husband in that car because he immediately went into shock. I put him in the car. I drove us back down to the beach, and I started running down the beach, going into the water after my kid. The only person that could have done this big, fat Samoan friend of mine that I used to swim with, I'm a hell of a swimmer, he grabbed me and he flipped me around and he pushed me down, kneeling in the sand, and he leaned on me, all 370 pounds of him, whatever he was, and leaning on me, he leaned over and he said, Godfrey, and he, don't you find him. And so one of my friends came walking out of the water carrying the body of my birthday kid. And the next thing I remember is being up at the hospital. Now, I want to tell you something about this. There's no atheists in foxholes. You can have an opinion on it all you want, but you got no idea what you're going to do until you've been there. And see, I've been there. And the thing that happens is that the first thing you do is you say, God, please don't let this baby die because I'm an incompetent human being. Don't take his life away because I'm a rotten mother. I mean, if there's any equity, if you're any kind of God, if there's anything going on with you at all, then you let me die. I don't belong here. You know, I feel like a package that was sent to the wrong address from the time I was born. You know, this baby loves life. If there's any equity, why don't you let him live and take me? My husband hates me. My kids don't need me. They need a human being for a parent, not me. You know, make it right. And the second thing that we do is we bargain. We go into that really private place of ours. We all have it. and we hunt around until we find the biggest bargaining chip that we have. And what I did was I went in there and I found it and I came out and I said, God, please let this baby live. And I will even quit drinking. Now, I shared that with my sponsor when I took my fifth step. Because she said more that she'd never known anybody as shame-driven as I was. And she wanted me to share that kind of stuff in the fifth step. Some other human being had to know this part of my life. And when I told her that, she took a big sigh. And she said, Franny, don't ever come to me whining about whether you're an alcoholic or not. I said, why do you say that? And she says, because no normal person equates the life of a child with a bottle of booze. And I went, wow. She said, that was your biggest bargaining chip, a bottle of scotch. I said, yeah. So I'm saying to any of you newcomers here, if you've ever had, or old-timers, if you ever had any doubts or reservations about whether you're an alcoholic or not, take this test. Ask yourself, have ever in your life you started some kind of a thing that starts with God, and it's a seemingly real or imaginary, it doesn't matter, but it's a situation that feels to you like life or death. And you ask God to change it, and then you say, and if you do this, I will even quit drinking. Have no doubt, my dears. If that's the kind of a thing where you have to bargain for your life and what you brought out of your secret hole was a bottle of booze, I got to tell you, there ain't no question what you are. The doctor, you know, he said, I'm sorry, he's gone, and I knew it. And we went home, my husband fell apart. He did the thing normal people do, grief. I didn't cry. The kind of world I had finally created for myself, I wasn't running with my hippie friends anymore. I was running with the gangsters. So I had my life living, I was living my life in compartments. I had my husband and my kids in this wonderful little house down at the beach, and everything looked okay from the front, except I was never available after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then over on the other side, I had these friends, because my husband was a fireman, so he'd work one day, he'd work 24 on, 24 off, you know, like that. And when he was off, there was a babysitter at my house, and I'm running with my gangster buddies. I finally found the piranhas. I finally found the bottom feeders. I found the people that I felt okay running with. I had to go to the absolute bottom of the heap to find anybody I could feel superior to. You know, we really don't find our level. We always try to stay a couple of points above it. But I had to get down where the whales leave it to find people that I could be comfortable with. And these kind of people, it's like life is a jungle, and you don't ever admit you're hurt, you don't ever admit you're sorry, you don't ever say, please help me, because if you do, if you show any vulnerability at all, you're going to get your throat cut and your money took. I watched people destroyed running with those people. I have to stay vague on that, simply because when my daughter was 15 years old, I went to the guy, and I said, I need to get out of this, I'm starting to know too much. And I don't want to run with you guys. And he let me go. And they were dangerous people. They're criminals, and a lot of them have never been in jail. And they just do awful things to people. And I was a part of that. So anyway, you know, I've never told anybody that before in a pitch. I guess maybe I've gotten old enough. Hopefully, most of them are dead. Anyway, well, maybe I feel safer. Probably true both ways. You know, 2 months later, my husband came to me and he said, okay, here's the deal, Franny. You know, you're an unnatural mother. You didn't even cry when Buddy got killed. I want to tell you something. He said, I'm divorcing you and I'm taking the kids away from you before you murder another one of my children. And see, he blamed me for the death of that child, and I blame myself, because the thing about an alcoholic is most of the alcoholics are family scapegoats. We get blamed for everything, and we may resist it, but the truth is inside we agree. Because we have so much universal guilt, it's almost a relief to find a place to put it. And the thing is that I wound up drinking more, and I did not wind up drinking more because of this tragedy. I wound up drinking more because now nobody could tell me not to drink. See, the reason I'm an alcoholic is because I drink too much. The reason I drink too much is because I'm an alcoholic. If I ever got into a really bad situation, husband's dying, mother dying, child dying, you know, the real tragedies of life where someone is really just taken away from you, I drank more. It wasn't the tragedy that had me drinking more. It was that because I'm an alcoholic, I will milk that situation to death. You know? And we are not willing to admit that. You know, at some level, we are not normal. And when we get well, we start making believe we're normal. What we can do is we can't act normal, but we can sure as hell thank God every day that nobody notices that we're not when we don't drink. See, that's the best I can wish for myself. Because the minute I start thinking I'm normal, I'm in trouble. Normal people don't have to go to AA meetings. Normal people don't have to get down on their knees in the morning and the evening and examine their life and ask God for help. You know, normal people don't have these little prayers with their kids. Well, maybe some of them do. They have a reality that I have. Because a nun gave this one to me, and it's the prayer of St. Sir Thomas More, and it says, Lord, I shall be very busy this day. Please, Lord, I may forget thee. Do not thou forget me. I have another one that says, okay, God, don't let me get us into anything you can't get us out of. Which is merely a contemporary translation of the previous, you know. So anyway, well, here I am now. I got this little, he was going to take the kids away from me, and what I did was I went out and I found, it says we're overachievers. And so I dedicated myself to the pursuit of finding a lawyer I could manipulate. And I found a lawyer that smelled like a newcomer. I interviewed four of them before I found him. But he smelled what I wanted. And I seduced him and I blackmailed him and I forced him to provide false witness and I got those kids. And when I was drinking, I used to talk about the fact that I was so hip, slick, and cool because I had gotten those kids in spite of everything I'd done. But the truth is, an honest man doesn't do much in a court against a liar, cheat, and a thief. And what happened was I used to take credit for being so cool and so smart. And what I didn't realize was later on is that we have no idea of the causality of our lives. We have absolutely no idea when that loop closes. You know, they talk about what goes around comes around. It can be a little loop. It can be instantaneous feedback from the universe. Or it can be a great big one where it doesn't come back until years later. So here I was thinking that I was cool because I held on to those kids. And the truth of the matter is, God let me hold on to them because they had to watch me get sober so that when their time came, they knew where to go. Now, that's my interpretation today. I do not presume to say that's the reason that I was able to hold on to them either. The longer I'm sober, the less I know. And the more opinionated I am about it. It's really a paradox. It really is. Well, anyway, what happened? To get on with the story, I wound up with this keen intellect and this fabulous education, finding the best job that I can find. And I wound up being a barmaid in a beer bar. And I'm wiping the bar down one day, and this snake came slithering in. Oh, he was wonderful. He danced the way I did. He shot pool the way I did. He was a liar, cheat, and a thief. And when you find one with that kind of magic, you know what you do. You marry him. So anyway, he stole a credit card, and we went off to Las Vegas and got married. I was so flattered. Because he really wanted to show me a good time. And 9 months later, I had another kid. And when that baby was 6 months old, that man... I have standards. Let me tell you about what my standards were for a man. And he fulfilled all of them. He had to be smart enough to hold a job, good looking enough to be an ornament, and stupid enough to put up with my shit. And he filled all three of those. And anyway, what happened? He's standing there saying, I'm leaving you. I can't take your game. I'm gone. And I'm thinking, what did I do? What happened here? So I remembered and he walked out. And I remembered my mother used to call AA. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made a couple of mistakes in that phone call. The first one was that I asked for the boss. And they had given me the Manhattan Beach Alano Club, and there was an awful argument on the other end of the phone, and finally some guy got on, and listen to what he said to me. He said, I know you asked for the boss, but I have to let you know that our higher power is not here at the moment to discuss any problems with you. However, I have been authorized to speak for him in any matters concerning alcoholism. My kind of man. And so anyway, I told him to come and get him. I had a live one, and they needed to straighten him out as soon as possible because he was killing me. And we used to have fights. We had violent physical fights, and the only time I ever called the police when I noticed it was my blood. I never called the police until I was losing. And I didn't lose too often, even though he was the boxing champ of the Fifth Fleet. And I had turned into a real monster. I was a police. I was a cop beater. One time, how did that happen? Somebody called the police, or I was losing, one of the two. But anyway, two cops were standing on our porch, and they were standing there looking at this drunken woman slobbering all over herself, telling them, "Take this man away. He's hurting me, and he's in as bad shape as I am." And the cops say, "I'm sorry, ma'am, we don't do that anymore. You know, husbands have rights, too, and we're starting to recognize it." So I said, "Well, throw him in the drunk tank, then." They said, "No, we can't take him out of his house and do that." And I said, I knew I had to put bars between him and me, because he was mad about something. So I said, "Okay, then, throw me in the drunk tank." And see, what I didn't know is these two police officers had been fighting with each other all evening in the patrol car. And so the cop said to me, "Well, I'm sorry, but we don't put people in the drunk tank just because they request it." I said, "Well, what do I need to do to get you to put me in jail?" And he said, "Well, you can hit a police officer." And with that, he stepped out of range. And I called cops his partner. And I wound up safely in jail for the night. And I thought they were going to release me because I was cute the next morning. And what I found out was I was being charged with felonious assault on a uniformed police officer. I asked them to do me a favor, and they turned it into that kind of a bad rap. Now I ask you, is that fair? You know, where my head was. Well, anyway, so this guy is leaving, and I'm calling AA, and the guy that I called said, "Look, we can't send anybody on that. The person that needs the help has to ask for it. So here's what we'll do. You come on up here, and I'll give you all sorts of sneaky ways to get him to start reading this literature that I'll give you." Well, that attracted me. And so I put on my 79 cent Zoris that I wore for special occasions. I bought them at Zoris. I had a camel colored corduroy hip huggers with bell bottoms. And I have to be honest about this. I don't know who owned them, but I found them in my backyard. Somebody must have left one of my parties without his pants. That's all I can tell you. And they fit me. That made them mine. I had a size 16 camel colored shirt that I bought from Goodwill that had a button missing, and I carefully pinned it from the inside right here. And a sweater that I'd stolen from Goodwill. It was also camel color. It was not the color that year, but if you're an active working drunk, camel is a wonderful color. You can puke through your nose all over yourself. And when it's dry, you can brush it off. It's a very light stain, you know. Well, anyway, I had a broken nose and two black eyes from the heated political discussion the night before, and I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous wondering if you were going to live up to my expectations. You know, and the guy saw me coming. They saw me coming, and he went like that and put me right there. And it was a newcomer's meeting. So he talked about stuff that I just was fascinated with, and one of the things that I realized is that I was home. The first night I hit AA, I was home. Two reasons. You smiled when nobody was looking. And the second thing is that you laughed the same time I did. Now, as I told you, I am an inappropriate human being. I never laughed, I never cried at the right time. My timing was always off. And I had learned from the time I was a kid, this was my training to be a phony, see, was that if I whatever feelings I had were invalid. I couldn't trust them. So I would watch the people around me, and if they laughed, then I'd laugh. And if they cried, I could squeeze out a tear or two. And that's what I let direct me. I never acted on what was going on inside of me. Because I knew I was wrong. I knew that I had to fake it, always. And what happened was when I took a breath and when I wanted to laugh, and then I looked around and everybody was just getting ready to just bust loose with laughter at the same time. And that was the most welcoming experience I could have had. And if there's anybody here who's thinking he's superior or she's superior because they're not inappropriate, I have a test. Has anyone here ever gone to the movies and had this hysterical scene up there on the screen that's just really, really funny? And you're sitting in your chair and you're laughing and scratching and rolling around and having the best time, and you suddenly realize that yours is the only voice you hear. You passed the test. So I stayed, and then he said, okay, he said, now we're going to have questions and answers. So I figured they were going to play Stump the Drunk or something like that. I have no idea. But I got my hand right up immediately. I said, how do I get my old man to stop beating me? And Frank said, you know, I haven't had anybody's old man beat me since I got sober. I had a lot of it before, but I haven't had any of it since. He said, but we're going to call Indian Jeannie. Jeannie, you come on up here and you share your experience, strength, and hope with this lady. So Jeannie bellied up to the podium and she said, my name's Jeannie and I'm an alcoholic, and any son of a bitch that lays a hand on me now that I'm sober is going to get a knife right in the gut. I said, hot dog, these people have the answers. And I stayed for that meeting, and I stayed for the 8:30 meeting, and I stayed for the midnight wrist slashers meeting. You know? Well, you know that meeting. You've gone to it. That's the one where you go and whine about the relationship that you're in that's driving you crazy, that your sponsor told you not to get involved in the first place. You know, they say advice is to be given, not to be received. A couple of my babies and I spoke a number of years ago, and one of the things that I said, you know, if you want what we have, because we are obviously having some fun, you got to do what we did. It's that simple. You can't get this program by osmosis. You know, you want it, if you want this sense of fun, this sense of joy, this sense of freedom, you got to do what we did. That's what we're going to talk about, you know? When I was at that place, well, there was a guy in the back, and he was looking at one of my babies, and he was saying, yes, I want it. So he started hanging around with us, and it was very apparent to us that he was not talking about the same thing we were talking about. So I told him, I said, Dee, listen, here's the deal. I said, have enough faith in Bill. Leave him alone. Let him get his act together. Let him get sober. You know, don't be one of these cripple shooters. And she said, okay. She said, I really like him. He's a great friend. She said, but I understand what you're talking about, because I appreciated that none of the men in our group thought it was a meat market. They honored and respected the women enough to let them get well and get sober before they started scheming on their bods. And at which point, at least the women could make a judgment, you know, instead of just being so eternally grateful that some sick son of a bitch walked up and said hi. So anyway, a couple of months later, she came up to me and she said, well, we did it. I said, I thought you were going to, like, stay out of any kind of intimate relationship for a year. She said, well, she said, I have 8 months and he has 4 months, and that makes a year. I said, right. And I laughed. I said, don't go too far away. Don't go running off in the bushes. And what happened was, what I found out was that I couldn't stay sober. And the reason I couldn't stay sober was because I was unwilling to tell you who I was. I came to those meetings. I came to meetings on a regular basis, and I was drunk, and I was sober, and I was drunk, and I was sober, and I was drunk, and I was drunk, and I was drunk. And the reason for that is because I wouldn't let you near me. They say you're only as sick as your secrets. I got to tell you I was sick, and I couldn't get the program. 3 years coming in and out and in and out, and the plane was going faster and faster and faster, and the landing field was getting shorter and shorter. I went to jail 6 times after I found AA. I was in 6 hospitals, I don't know how many times. I remember one time a doctor was sewing up the front of my face one more time, and he just went like that, and he walked across the room, and he turned around, and he looked at me, and he was crying. And here's this little tiny upholstery needle, you know, with the black silk hanging down in my face. And I said to him, "What's your problem?" And he said to me, "You are such a heartbreaker. Do you know what it's like to be putting stitches in where I just took them out last week?" I said, "Hey, do what you have to do and shut up. Because where I came from, you didn't ask for help. You didn't admit you're hurt. You didn't do any of that. You got your stuff taken care of between 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning, because that's the only time there was no action on the streets." So that's what I had turned into, and here I am trying to come to AA and do it on the sly, and I couldn't do it. And there was this lady I couldn't stand. I just couldn't tolerate her. When she talked, you could hear a pin drop. And when I talked, it was like somebody said, "Coffee break." And I hated her. And I was going to go up to her, and I was really going to confront her, and I walked up to her, and his name is Dottie McCafferty. I said, "Dottie, I got to talk to you." And she's a little shrimp. She looked at me with these laser blue eyes, and she said, "Yeah, what do you want?" And I was going to tell her that I thought she was a phony, and that she needed to be confronted, and that she had this sycophantical group that, you know, followed her around everywhere, laughing and scratching, and I couldn't stand it. And I said to her, "Will you be my sponsor?" And she looked me right in the eye. She said, "God, Franny, I don't know. You're a loser." And I did the thing that saved my life. I did the thing. I stood there and I took a deep breath because I knew this was the last house on the block. If I didn't make it here, I was dead. I knew that. And I said the thing. I said, "Please, from the heart." And you know, see, here's the deal. I was so busy. I lived in a little fortress all my own, and I'm busy trying to man the barricades all by myself. And I never had any room in my life for another human being because, you know, you just got to survive, man. You got to stay drunk as much as you can because that makes it tolerable, and keep the Indians from coming over the walls. That's the way my life was. That was the way I had to survive. So there had never been any room for another human being or anything else in my life for a long, long time. And when I looked at that woman and I said, "Please," I was saying, "Please come into my fort." I was making room for another human being. And when I made room for the other human being, you know what happened? There was space for God. She said, "Well," and she put her hand out. One of her lieutenants gave her a directory, you know. And she marched it. You've got those kind of dragon ladies out here, I know. Peggy Martin, for one. All right, so she marched it and she said, "Yeah, these are the meetings I go to. I'll see you there." So I started going to those meetings, and what I found out was I had inadvertently joined up with a den of step Nazis. That was not my intention either, but you know what? These people were having fun. And they didn't want to hear anything I had to say unless I was talking about the steps. And you know, more than anything else, what I wanted them to do was invite me to the movies on Friday night. And I found out that if I talked about working the steps and I was honest about it, they would do that. So I started doing that. And one time this little Indian broad walked up to me and she said, "Franny, my life is a disaster and everybody told me to ask you to be my sponsor because that way the two of us would be kept busy." And I said, Becky, you stay right there. And I went zipping over to Dottie, and I said, Dottie, Becky asked me to be her sponsor. What do I do now? And she said, Franny, she said, you stay one step ahead of her. She'll never know the difference. And I have to tell you the truth. That's the only thing that I've had to do is to stay one step ahead of them. And, you know, I got a bunch of women that I have sponsored, and I found out that a woman coming into this program and trying to get sober on the male energy usually does not succeed. Because as long as she denies that women have their own power, what she can never do is give herself her own power. You know? And see, I simply chose not to be a cripple. I went to my sponsor one time. I said, Dottie, must I remain celibate for the rest of my life? She looked me right in the eyeball. She said, maybe. I said, Janet's got her fella. Susie's got her guy. You know, Noah's got hers. Where's mine? She said, Franny. She said, as sick as you are, any guy that's interested in you isn't worth your time. And you know what? I recognize the truth of that statement. She said, I firmly believe that the reason God is giving you this time is so that you can work the steps and start getting well so that eventually you will attract the kind of man that I think you might be capable of attracting if these stupid men around this program leave you alone long enough for you to get well. And what happened to me was there was one stupid guy. Hey, wait, I got to tell you something. When I talk about the guys and he and she and it on this program, and I'm telling you, you know, give each other the time to get well, let me tell you something. I really am speaking more out of defense of the men. Because most of those really cute little ladies that come in with their acrylic nails and their do, you know, they are baby barracudas. They're going to survive. We know that, don't we, girls? We know that. You know, it's the guys that get destroyed. So anyway, I don't know where I was. I don't even know why I went off on that. But, you know, the point is they left me alone long enough for me to get my act together. And, you know, what happened was I did find a guy that was really neat. And, you know, it's not the same guy. This guy was fine until he tried marijuana maintenance. And I watched a grown man turn into a worm in 6 months. But I got married twice on the program, and my husband, my best friend, my partner in life, the guy that I finally was grown up enough to try to realize that a relationship is about learning, not about getting, he's going to talk tomorrow, you know. And what I wish for you is I hope every one of you is sitting there in all innocence one day, and some sick newcomer walks up and says, will you be my sponsor? Because I'll tell you what, there is no better way to grow than to help somebody stand on their own 2 feet. And I'll tell you this, you cannot be self-obsessed when you're there. Because what you do is you have a sponsor, and now you're sponsoring people, and you're holding on this side, and you're holding on this side. And when you hold on like that, you can't fall down. Thank you.